This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Fighting in Israel and Gaza has quickly escalated. On one side, worries about Israelis coming under attack.
All of them will now be under a looming shadow of rocket fire from Gaza on Israeli population centers.
From Palestinians, a resignation that they do not have the upper hand.
There's very little they can do. Israel controls the airspace, the territorial waters, the land, the resources, the crossing points.
Also today, Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States.
You either take the path to peace and you negotiate. And negotiate means give and take. Or you continue this conflict.
And a different kind of information war on vaccines, getting the word out in refugee camps.
This basic information, what is the vaccine about? How does it work? Nobody told them.
All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you with us today. We begin with Afghanistan, where citizens are still reeling from a horrific attack this past weekend, a triple bombing in Kabul that killed dozens of schoolgirls. As U.S. troops prepare to leave Afghanistan by September, many Afghans are worried that the situation will get worse. Our next guest is deeply invested in what happens over the next few months and beyond. Roya Rahmani is Afghanistan's ambassador to the U.S. I asked her about the attacks last weekend and what the Afghan government is doing to protect the community of ethnic Hazara people who were killed and are increasingly the targets of extremists.
The Afghan government is doing all that they can. The reason that they are mushrooming here and there is because it's an insurgency, because unfortunately, the cost of perpetrating these acts are very low, because there is an environment of conflict that is continuing to exist because of the Taliban's continuous violence.
I mean, the question on many people's minds is who is behind these attacks and how they can be stopped. What is your assessment?
The people who are behind these attacks are terrorists. I don't know what other name I could possibly give them. How they can stop is by bringing an end to this conflict, regardless of who says, who claims and doesn't claim it. The issue is that there is this environment that continues to exist that allow for such things to happen. To stop it, we need the support of our international allies, the regional community, the regional countries, because we have to also look at where the terrorists are able to get their finances, how they are able to get the explosives within the country, how they are managing these attacks. All of these different aspects of this conflict needs to be addressed.
So the Taliban did not claim responsibility for the attack on Saturday. I'm just wondering, what more could President Ashraf Ghani have done to move the peace negotiations with the Taliban forward?
The president has done everything that we can do to move the negotiations forward, and he is continuing to do so. The president is working continuously with all the political factions in Afghanistan. He is trying to solidify the consensus for a united front during the negotiations. He has announced that he is willing to shorten his term and resign for his successor, given that they would continue a peace mandate. So from our side, we are willing to do all we can. The problem is that the Taliban, unfortunately, have presented that they are not interested in peace, but in power.
Well, I mean, the Afghan government was left out of peace talks with the Taliban, even with the U.S. troops in the country. It feels like the Taliban has the upper hand there, not the government, and peace is not moving forward. Where is the problem?
It is a conflict over power. It is not about peace. It is not about the well-being of the people. It's not about the will of the people. And unfortunately, the conflict will continue as long as any group would try to impose on the Afghan people their way or their view.
Do you think it was a good idea then for the U.S. to leave now?
Well, that was their decision. And as stated, we respect the decision that the U.S. has made. But as President Ghani has said, it is a risk and opportunity at the same time. Right now, as we have said, and the rest of the international community also echoes, there is no reason for this conflict to continue. The very basis of the continuation of conflict by the Taliban was that there is presence of foreign troops. There is an occupation, as they put it. But that is finished. That's over. The troops are withdrawing. So what is the reason that the Afghan people are continuously suffering and bearing the brunt of this? It is a conflict and perpetuation of violence merely for power and at the expense of innocent citizens of Afghanistan.
Ambassador Rahmani, a lot of people in Afghanistan are concerned about what comes next. Among experts, there's an almost unanimous belief that the Taliban are aiming to come back to power. You're in Washington right now, but if that turns out to be the case, would you go back to Afghanistan with your family?
When we opened to the Taliban an unconditional offer of peace, that was expected that they would come back and be part of the community. I mean, what I understand from your question, Marco, is that you are saying that they will come back in the way that they did in 1996.
Yes.
I would say that's not possible. That's not possible because that will be met with a huge resistance by the people in Afghanistan. We have security forces who are ready to fight them. They are already doing so, and they will fight hard, and the result will be a continuation of a very bloody conflict.
Ambassador, in your heart of hearts, can you imagine the Taliban coming into power in that kind of democratic way?
I know that there is a lot of differences. Unfortunately, we have not seen a major shift in their position vis-a-vis certain very critical issues, but the option is not easy. You either take the path to peace and you negotiate. And negotiate means give and take. Or you continue this conflict, which the second option is not something anybody would desire or anybody would like to see. And I repeat again, it is going to be a catastrophe immediately for us and long term for the rest of the world and the region.
And if the Taliban doesn't care about catastrophe, I mean, you already said this is about power, not the best interests of the people.
Unfortunately, I can't say any more than what I already said. It is what it is. The people of Afghanistan, the security forces, cannot agree to the same comeback of Taliban as they have experienced it over two decades ago.
Roy Al-Rahmani is the Afghan ambassador to the United States. Ambassador, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Across the globe, millions of asylum seekers and migrants are being left out of national vaccine programs. That's according to a report from the World Health Organization obtained by the Guardian newspaper. Activists in Europe say this is a big problem, both in terms of vaccine access and outreach. The World's Lydia Manalidou has more from Athens.
Back in Afghanistan, Rahima Yousafi was a security guard at a women's prison. Today, she's living at a refugee camp on Lesbos Island and is on the lookout for dangerous COVID-19 rumors.
My son, he has watched a video on Facebook that saying that we should never do the vaccination for COVID-19 because it will make us like mad.
Crazy, yeah. Do you believe that?
No.
Yousafi wants to get the shot, but for now she'll have to wait. Greece started vaccinating its general population in January. It said that asylum seekers in camps would be incorporated into the vaccine rollout, but that hasn't happened yet.
It's a frustration. Public health is a state responsibility, and the state needs to take the initiative to reach everybody.
Apostolos Vaizis is a medical doctor and the executive director of Intersos, an NGO. He's on an advisory group that's working with the Greek Ministry of Health to coordinate a plan for asylum seekers. He says there is a proposal to go into all the refugee camps across Greece and vaccinate the more than 35,000 people who live there.
It's a good idea. When and how? That's another question.
He says getting this population vaccinated has been slowed down by bureaucracy and politics, and that that's been really frustrating.
And of course, everybody else needs to be vaccinated. Don't get me wrong. I'm not just a refugee friendly and against the rest of the people.
He says people in refugee camps are at a higher risk of contracting the virus. He and his colleagues analyzed case numbers in Greece and found that, compared to the general population, the risk of COVID-19 infection was up to 3 times higher for people living in camps.
Because first of all, they cannot keep a distance. They have to leave many people together. They cannot wash their hands because there's not enough water.
And protective equipment, like masks, is also scarce. This is why Vaizi says this population should get priority. But right now, the only asylum seekers eligible for the vaccine in Greece are those whose camps are in popular tourist destinations. The government is rushing to vaccinate everyone on the Aegean Islands as the country reopens for tourism in about a week. At the refugee camp on Leros Island, authorities played a message over the camp's loudspeaker recently to let residents know they could sign up for the COVID-19 vaccine.
But nobody registered for it.
Katarina Kahane is with Echo 100 Plus, an NGO on Leros. She says up until then, there had been no official campaign to get asylum seekers educated on the vaccine.
This basic information, what is the vaccine about, how does it work, what kinds of vaccines there are, nobody told them. Yeah? So there is a huge lack of information.
And she says it's fallen to people like her to fill that gap. Kahane turned to a WhatsApp group and asked fellow NGO workers to send vaccine information in Farsi, Arabic and Somali. Those are the main languages spoken at the camp on Leros.
We immediately used it and, you know, we printed it out and had folders and were walking through the camp and around the camp and gave it to people.
She says just like in the general population, people within the camp were skeptical. Kahane worries about outreach if and when vaccines become more widely available for asylum seekers in the country. We contacted several Greek agencies to find out the status of the plan for all asylum seekers, but did not hear back. Other European countries have moved more quickly than Greece.
Across Europe, the situation is actually better than maybe expected.
Catherine Woolard is with the European Council on Refugees and Exiles, an alliance of more than 100 NGOs across 40 European countries. She says asylum seekers in several nations are able to access vaccines along with the general population. One example is Germany,
where very quickly people who were being accommodated in centres were vaccinated.
She says other countries like Switzerland and Ireland are also prioritising vaccinating asylum seekers who are living in centres and detention facilities. Woolard is also tracking what governments are doing to reach asylum seekers in their own language. Belgium, France, and the Netherlands, for example, issued vaccine-related information in different languages.
أسعد الله أوقاتكم سيداتي وسادتي.
Switzerland has been running this TV and video campaign about the COVID-19 vaccine in more than a dozen languages. Woolard says her group will continue monitoring vaccinations for asylum seekers across Europe. Meanwhile, she's also concerned about other groups falling through the cracks. That includes people who are undocumented and displaced, like the Roma people, an ethnic minority in Europe. Woolard says European countries have a lot of work to do to ensure those people aren't left behind either. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanoulidou in Athens, Greece.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The confrontation between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip escalated in a very serious way today. The Israeli military carried out a series of deadly airstrikes in Gaza throughout the day. Later, Tel Aviv was barraged by rockets fired from Gaza, many intercepted by Israel's anti-missile defense system. This is the most serious outbreak of fighting in years between Israel and Hamas. Earlier today, I spoke with Hanan Ashrawi. She's a veteran Palestinian politician in Ramallah and says that deep disagreement over the city of Jerusalem is what sparked this latest escalation.
Israel has systematically been trying to transform the character of Jerusalem, to carry out demographic engineering or even ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem by getting rid of as many Palestinians and by bringing in and imposing Israeli Jewish settlers.
Our reporter in Jerusalem recently spoke with Palestinians in East Jerusalem. A lot of them expressed frustration with the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah, where the Palestinian Authority is based. As we see these things escalate between Israel and the Palestinians, what is the role of the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank?
Yeah, look, the question is not the Palestinian leadership. The question is this systematic assault on Jerusalem and on the holy sites. And the Palestinian leadership is also under occupation. And there's very little they can do. Israel controls the airspace, the territorial waters, the land, the resources, the crossing points, and can attack at will, kill, destroy, demolish homes, evict people, and so on. This is Israel. This is a military occupation that is absolutely ruthless and brutal.
Doesn't the Palestinian leadership have a role to play in being the voice of the Palestinian people? I mean, it seems like Hamas has taken that lead in your absence.
Well, of course, if you want the Palestinians to resort to armed struggle, then they would be listened to. The problem is Hamas did resort to armed struggle in response to the incessant violence, the escalated attacks on the Palestinians. And the Palestinian authority or leadership or the PLO remained committed to a nonviolent negotiated settlement. That's what undermined the leadership in the PLO and Fatah and so on. And that's what strengthened Hamas, because people are seeing it's doing something. It's responding to Israeli violence and Israeli cruelty.
Do you disagree then with the way Hamas fired rockets at Jerusalem? Is firing?
It's a question of sending a message, a clear message, that if Israel wants any peace or security, it cannot continue to enslave a whole people. It cannot continue unilaterally to steal land and build settlements and create facts. It cannot continue to terrorize a whole population and act with full impunity. So that this is the reason why Palestinians feel that they will not lie down and die quietly.
As far as the leadership of the Palestinians, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas made the decision to postpone the election. Was that a mistake?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a mistake. He shouldn't have postponed it. But after all, there were lots of hints and messages sent telling him that if you carry out the elections, you will lose your majority. But it also made him lose a lot of support, and it angered many people. If you are democratic, you have to accept the results.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said all sides need to de-escalate. Hanan Ashrawi, what do you want to hear from the White House on this recent round of violence?
I think the White House should say international law applies. The White House should say that there is accountability for an occupation that continues with impunity, and it should try to end this occupation. And it should engage in a serious strategic dialogue with the Palestinians. And most importantly, should say that Palestinians have equal rights. I believe that there has to be a real historic and strategic understanding of the situation and the causes of conflict, and try to resolve it in a way that is based on international law and on equal rights.
Veteran Palestinian politician Hanan Ashrawi speaking with us from Ramallah. Thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome. It's my pleasure.
We'll hear more from Tel Aviv about the latest rocket attacks later in the show. President Biden wants to transform his State Department. More diversity is a top priority. Although today we learned that Biden's pick to be the next U.S. ambassador to Japan is former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Critics say that these appointments often come as rewards to political allies and top donors, which in turn can undercut diversity. Joining me now is former U.S. Ambassador Piper Campbell. She co-chairs the group Women Ambassadors Serving America. Ambassador, last month you were the lead co-signer of a letter addressed to President Biden. You were encouraging him to commit to diversity and gender parity in diplomatic appointments. What made you want to lead this effort?
Within the field of national security, it's been particularly difficult for women to break through to leadership positions. And the ambassadorial positions are key leadership positions. And I talk to my students. I teach at American University, and I regularly hear from my students that seeing women, seeing people like them in these really publicly visible positions is one of the things that makes them believe that this career is possible for them as well.
What is the current situation with diversity and gender equality in the State Department, and what's kind of been the trend over time?
The trend's been sadly going backwards. Gender parity at the ambassadorial level peaked at 40% in 2017. We lost a disproportionate number of our African-American and Hispanic senior officials over the last 4 years, and we weren't well represented for diversity even before the last 4 years.
I want to note, Ambassador Campbell, that you've held some key positions, U.S. Ambassador to Mongolia, also the U.S. Mission to ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. As a career diplomat yourself, how have you confronted these problems of diversity and gender inequality?
It's always shocking when you walk into a room and you are the only woman in the room. And it always bothered me when I would walk into a room and see only white faces at the table. In addition to serving in Mongolia and serving at the U.S. mission to ASEAN, I was consul general in Basra, southern Iraq. And I felt that it was extremely powerful that when I walked into a meeting to interact with Iraqi gentlemen, and also occasionally women, I was a diplomat and I was there as a diplomat. The fact of my gender, I think, contributed to that message coming after a heavily armed U.S. military presence that had been there before we opened the consulate. And I believe that I was able to have those conversations in a different way.
As to today's news that Biden wants Rahm Emanuel to be his ambassador to Japan, I mean, one argument against another plum job to a white man with great Chicago experience, but apparently very little experience in Japan. A counter argument, though, Emanuel is a proven, tough tactician who is known to get his way. So why shouldn't the president choose that person?
And I'm not going to argue against Rahm Emanuel. I'm just going to argue for parity across appointments. A point I would want to make is parity isn't just in numbers. It's also in the posts to which people are assigned. So it's great that we were at 40% women ambassadors in 2017. But women ambassadors disproportionately serve in small posts, in African posts, in multilateral organizations, which I certainly enjoyed serving in a multilateral organization, and in the former Soviet states. We want to see women in all types of posts.
Former U.S. Ambassador Piper Campbell, co-chair of Women Ambassadors Serving America, speaking with us about diversity and gender parity in the State Department. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for your time.
It was my pleasure.
You're listening to The World. Getting a coronavirus vaccine has brought up all kinds of medical and personal questions.
I'm going to look away because I'm scared of needles.
For pregnant women, those questions become more complex. Plus, lessons about home that archaeologists learned in a cave in South Africa from people who lived there 2 million years ago. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We return now to the confrontation between Israel and Gaza. Today, the Israeli military carried out a series of deadly airstrikes in Gaza, targeting the militant group Hamas. At one point, a 13-story building used by Hamas leadership was hit. Then the building collapsed. Israeli officials say they had warned occupants beforehand to leave. Later, a sustained barrage of rockets was fired by militants in Gaza, the city of Tel Aviv. Israel's anti-missile defense system intercepted many of the incoming rockets. Early reports said at least one Israeli woman was killed outside of Tel Aviv. At least 28 Palestinians were also killed today, according to health officials in Gaza. This is the most serious outbreak of fighting in years between Israel and Hamas. The World's Ariel Osaran joins me now. Ariel, you're in Tel Aviv. Where were you when the sirens began ringing out warning of incoming rockets?
Yeah, Marco. So I was actually, the sirens began about an hour and a half ago. I was driving with my wife to a family event east of Tel Aviv, and we heard the sirens also on the radio and also outside. And what we did is we followed protocol. We stopped the car on the side of the road. We got out, we laid on our stomachs, and I could see dozens of rockets right over our heads, and many of them, if not all, were intercepted by the Iron Dome system.
And what is happening in and around Tel Aviv right now? What do people do when those sirens go off?
Well, Tel Aviv is more distant from Gaza than the towns that are closer, that have been suffering hundreds of rockets throughout the day. In Tel Aviv, they have a minute and a half to reach bomb shelters. Not all buildings do have these shelters. If they don't, people are instructed to go to the stairwell and just wait until the siren is gone. But there are people who are intending on sleeping in bomb shelters today, and school in the Tel Aviv area was canceled for tomorrow, and activity in the Ben Gurion airport, which is the main airport, international airport of Israel, activity has been halted as well.
When was the last time this happened, Tel Aviv under attack?
So, you know, throughout the years, there have been rounds of escalation between Israel and Hamas. Usually, there's different gradual levels of escalation. So usually the smaller rounds will be rockets towards the southern town area. But in Tel Aviv, it hasn't been like this since 2014, the last biggest confrontation between the sides. And in a few minutes, Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Gantz are going to give public announcements to explain where we're headed towards in these next few days.
What are Israeli leaders saying right now about what comes next? I mean, I know Netanyahu will come out, but what are we anticipating?
So the military and also leaders have said that they will not allow targeting civilians in populated areas. They said they will escalate the strikes. Just like you said, what prompted this recent barrage was the destroying of that 13-story building. So a few minutes ago, the Israeli military gave an alert to residents of four other multiple-story buildings in Gaza, warning them that their buildings will be targeted very soon. And so it appears that we're headed to a very tense few days.
The world's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much and be safe.
Thanks, Marco.
Nepal is struggling through a surge of COVID cases. Remember, Nepal shares a long border with India. A devastating outbreak is still raging there. And now, roughly every 10 minutes, someone in Nepal is dying because of the coronavirus. The number of recorded infections is doubling every 3 days. Vaccines are also scarce. Kathmandu resident Bunu Dungana is recovering from COVID. We're reaching her in lockdown at her home in the densely crowded city center of Kathmandu. Thank you for speaking with us, Bunu. How are you feeling?
Hi. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to my story. My symptoms were very severe and I had to go to the hospital. The surge was not as high as it is right now, where there are no beds available at the hospitals now. I'm recovering now. I just have a little bit of exhaustion.
How common these days is it to hear in Kathmandu about a friend or relative who's also gotten infected with COVID?
It's very common now. You know, once I tested positive, people around me also started testing. And it was just like all my friends and then my family member, my mother. It just sort of was just spiraling, you know. And suddenly in now 3 weeks, it's like an avalanche that we cannot stop. The situation is really bad.
Thank goodness you're on the mend today, Bunu. It can't help that many of the neighborhoods in Kathmandu are so densely populated. How close to one another are the homes in your part of town?
There's just like, I think, 5 meters. Mm. Like, when my neighbor's dog is barking, people think it's my dog, you know?
Yeah, so really close. So, and I gather many of those households are intergenerational?
Yes, the houses that my house surrounds. In fact, all the houses have grandparents. Yeah, it's intergenerational. You know, where I live, if I go to the terrace, I can actually see the funeral pyres, the cremation fire. I can see the smoke, just unending smoke coming up. And it's just so heartbreaking and it's so scary, you know, the situation that we are at in this moment right now.
Seeing that every day, that can't be very soothing.
Yes.
It's also got to be kind of terrifying.
Yes, it is.
I gather your mother, who's rather elderly, she has coronavirus. She somehow managed, though, to get one vaccine before the surge hit Nepal. Is she able to get a second dose?
No, the second dose is nowhere in sight. She got her first vaccination in February, and we are in May right now, and we have no idea when she's going to get another dose. I think only 1% of the population is fully vaccinated here, and the only solution everybody says is vaccine, and I don't know how we're going to get that here.
Bunu, when you see the news and you see other countries like the United States slowly getting the population vaccinated, what occurs to you?
Yeah, I would like to tell the American people who are not getting vaccinated to please send their vaccines to us. We are dying for vaccines, and people who are refusing to vaccinate, we just can't believe sometimes when we hear. Yeah.
Bunu Dungana lives in Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, where she's a researcher and photographer. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Hope things improve in Nepal.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Thank you.
Beer, donuts, coupons, these are just some of the things that places are offering up to encourage people to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Can that little extra something do the trick? The World's Alana Gordon looked into this.
It's hard to believe, but in a matter of weeks, some parts of the globe have gone from trying to get enough vaccines to now having them and trying to convince people to take them. Like Serbia, it's got a surplus now. So last week, the president had a bold offer. Get vaccinated this month and get $30. Yes, cash for shots. That same day, inside a shopping center in Belgrade, a line of people stretched around stores and up an escalator to a new walk-in vaccine clinic. The first 100 to show up got a gift card. To the east in Romania, Brand Castle had another idea. Visit the legendary home of Dracula this month and get stabbed while you're there. In the arm. Alex Priscu is the castle's marketing manager. He says they set up the vaccine drive last weekend. They expected about 200 people to show, and
we have managed to go further than the limit, so to say, because we've closed the weekend with 400 vaccines. But our goal is just to raise awareness.
The jab also gets a person free access to the castle's torture chambers. But can a little incentive really make a difference on this massive public health challenge? Jeff Lazarus is a professor at the Barcelona Institute for Global Health.
I think incentives within reason are a good approach. I think they can make good sense.
He says, given that as many people as possible need to be vaccinated to prevent outbreaks of the coronavirus, why not see if a shot of beer for a COVID shot might help? Incentives for vaccines aren't new. Places like Brazil have successfully used cash transfers for childhood vaccinations. But it's not just tangible gifts that can be powerful for COVID-19. Think about green passes in Israel. They allow access to gyms, concerts, restaurants, and to travel. Jeff Lazarus is in Denmark right now. When he has the chance to get vaccinated, he says he is on it. It will make it even easier to get into places.
For example, I'll go to a yoga class tomorrow. So I got a test yesterday. I got the results within 24 hours. And with my negative test, I can go in and do yoga for an hour.
No negative test or vaccine, no entry. But these kinds of incentives won't move everyone. Lazarus's own surveys across more than a dozen countries have found that those with very low confidence in the vaccines probably won't be won over this way.
In the end, if there's not trust in the vaccines, the science behind the vaccines, in the health authorities administering the vaccines, I don't think a donut or a drink is going to be the incentive that gets people to go get vaccinated.
What's needed is better education on how the vaccines are developed, on their safety. This is partly why Zoran Radovanovic was disappointed with that $30 incentive in Serbia. He's a retired epidemiologist at the University of Belgrade. He worries that for some, cash might spark more suspicion. Like, what's the catch?
If the government insists on such a measure, then it might be good for them, but not necessarily for me.
Radovanovic is 81 years old. The memory of the campaign to eradicate smallpox in Serbia 50 years ago is still fresh. Back then, he says everyone wanted to get vaccinated. They crowded health centers because they knew these shots would save them and their children. They understood vaccination was a public good. Now, Radovanovich hopes with these new vaccines for COVID-19, as the holdouts see more people they know getting the shot and observe the benefits, that will make the real difference. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Talk about a home that was built to last. In South Africa, researchers say they found a home that's nearly 2 million years old. Key features that suggest it's a home, the use of fire, and some basic stone toolmaking. Michael Shazen is a professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto and co-director of the Van der Werck Cave Research Project. That's the name of the cave where the home was found. Your team, Michael, found evidence of tool use and the use of fire dating back 1.8 million years. How did you figure that out?
It's not easy. We use a combination of fairly complex methods to figure out the age of the different levels that were laid down in the cave. And basically, we're able to say that the sand blew into this cave incredibly slowly, just bits and pieces every year. And we're able to create a clock, basically taking us back around almost 2 million years.
That is wild. So the early humans that were around 2 million years ago were classified as Homo erectus. What does this finding add to our knowledge of Homo erectus?
I think it adds a lot. We've known about Homo erectus from sites in Europe, mostly from sites in East Africa, like Olduvai Gorge, which are open-air sites. They tell us a lot about how Homo erectus lived on the landscape. At Van der Werck, I think we're really sure that humans are the agent that brought that fire into the cave. We don't know yet whether those early humans were making fire or simply collecting wildfire. And that's one of the great challenges we now face.
I'm curious, Michael, what does fire evidence look like 2 million years after the thing burned? Did you actually hold something in your hand that had burned 2 million years ago?
The initial observations were actually microscopic. Because fire, you're right, it's not like an artifact. You know, an artifact I can pick up. Fire, I don't find fire from a million years ago. Mm. I find the traces of that fire.
You and other researchers involved are not from South Africa, but that is where this ongoing excavation is. How do people living nearby think of this cave? And because of that, has it been problematic working inside the cave?
Local people have a lot of reverence and respect for deep water holes and caves, which are related with powerful spirits. We share that reverence for this place, although our reverence comes from a different place. So I found a lot of success working with the local community because of this overlap of respect for this place, coming from different directions. So I've learned a tremendous amount while also trying to understand how we can contribute through educational programs, helping develop a tourist industry, and sometimes simply by listening and hearing what we're being told instead of doing what academics like me do very well, which is talk.
Are you working with South Africa to keep this work and the artifacts there?
About half of our team are South African researchers. We have the privilege of working with the McGregor Museum in Kimberley, which is the repository for everything we excavate and for all the finds from Van der Werck Cave. And then we work with local community organizations. So there are lots of spaces for partnership and for really working together, which is incredibly rewarding.
In the fields of archaeology and anthropology, I mean, what are the criteria for a space being called a home?
That's a great question because it's not a single criterion. You know, that I think this year has been a great year to learn how flexible the world is and how much fluctuation that is.
Why?
Well, this year I just felt, I think we've all felt this sense that what our homes are changed so much in ways that I could never have imagined. Living such that I rarely left the four walls of my house. And I think that's very different from what I've usually experienced. You know, I usually go off to the field every year for a couple months. I go off to work every day. And it was interesting to me to watch how all of us were able to adapt. You know, the world changed. It forced us to change. And it said to me that there's flexibility in terms of our ideas of what a home is.
Michael Shazen is a professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto and co-director of the Van der Werck Cave Research Project in South Africa. Michael, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Here in the U.S., the medical guidance for adults is crystal clear. Take the COVID vaccine. But if you're a woman who's pregnant and you start doing research about what other governments advise, things can get murky. Reporter Valeria Fernandez takes us through making this decision for herself in Phoenix, Arizona, with input from several other parts of the world.
It was late February and I was pregnant and tired. Just jumped in my car.
Well, I just got another tip that maybe... But they say you had to be at noon giving vaccines.
I got a tip that there were leftover COVID-19 shots at a vaccination clinic 40 minutes away, but no luck.
I just used up the energy that I had. I think I'm just going to go get myself some lunch.
I knew that pregnant women have elevated risk of facing severe COVID-19 complications or even death. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says pregnant people can choose to get the shot and advises them to check with their doctor. I was ready to get the shot. But then I had a sudden change of heart.
I was kind of afraid you'd take the vaccine.
That's my mother. She's in Uruguay, where I'm from. Her opinion matters a lot to me.
There are new vaccines, and we really don't know what the effects will be in the future.
Then she told me something else that made me hesitate.
Yes, I told you that in Uruguay it was not recommended for pregnant women. And I take very seriously our health ministry recommendations.
That was 3 months ago. Uruguayan health authorities, like many other places, were not recommending women get the shot due to lack of data. I wonder how other women in Latin America were making their decision, if there even were shots available. In Guatemala, health authorities are not giving the shot to any pregnant person. In Mexico, vaccines are only available for those 50 and up and health workers. I talked to Elvira Olvera, who is 7 months pregnant, in Mexico City. If I get a chance at the shot when they start giving it, she told me, it will be a hard decision because I don't know if it will affect the baby. Elvira and I have the same dilemma, but we have different information depending on our location. Each government has to consider the type of vaccine, the risks of infection in a community, and supply, says Ruth Fader, the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. I ask her, why is it so difficult to issue a recommendation?
There has been a long-standing problem that evidence on new drugs and new vaccines in terms of safety and efficacy in pregnancy follows evidence on those questions for other adults. So there is a lag.
The World Health Organization says that women can make the decision if the benefits outweigh the risks in their unique situation. Faden says that's a lot of pressure to put on pregnant women, on top of the pressures we already face from society. Everyone has an opinion about how we give birth, how long we breastfeed, how we rock our babies to sleep, how we burp them.
Everything is questioned, right? And there is a tremendous sense of responsibility and what we that pregnant women feel. Also, when we know in our hearts, but also when we study this, that if you ask a pregnant woman in a decision like this, what is the most important thing to you? And they will say the health of the baby.
I have to agree with that. Misinformation also puts pressure on women. For example, one myth is that the Pfizer shot could cause infertility. I've heard it. Even after the myth was debunked by the Associated Press, a healthcare professional in Arizona repeated that falsehood and told me I will lose my baby if I took the shot and I will be infertile. Faden reassured me.
There is nothing, no basis, no shred of even theoretical reasoning why this vaccine should affect fertility.
La joven estaba embarazada de 5 meses. Tenía 27 años.
Recently, two pregnant women in Uruguay died of COVID-19. Shortly after, Uruguayan health authorities prioritized access to vaccines for pregnant people. Meanwhile, researchers analyzed early data from the CDC on pregnant people in the U.S. who took the Moderna and Pfizer shots already and concluded it doesn't pose a serious safety risk. But by then, I had already made my decision.
You will be getting the Pfizer vaccine today and first dose. Would you prefer right or left arm?
Left arm.
Left arm? Okay, perfect.
For me, the benefits of getting the shot outweighed the risks. New evidence shows that as a nursing mother, I could pass immunity to my breastfeeding son and protect my unborn baby. And my experience could become part of that research. That was powerful enough for me.
Okay, I'm gonna look away because I'm scared of needles. Give me a second.
I held my breath and cried a little. In a second, I felt the weight of the world. Have I made the right choice? I was privileged to have a choice to make in the first place, even though it wasn't an easy one. For The World, I'm Valeria Fernandez in Phoenix, Arizona.
Finally today, Milan's famed opera house La Scala opened its doors yesterday for the first time in more than 6 months to a capacity crowd, capacity being 25% of a full house. Just 500 music lovers were allowed inside. The 2,000-seat theater was not the La Scala they knew pre-pandemic.
We covered maybe 75% of the seats with a floor, and there we have room for a big orchestra keeping the distance.
That's Paolo Bezzana, head of the press office at La Scala. He says tickets for the concert were all but impossible to get, even for him.
I usually have a seat at concerts. I keep one for me. But in this case, there were so many requests for Riccardo Chailly conducting.
One plus side of the limited capacity, the audience was confined to La Scala's balcony boxes. Last night, conductor Riccardo Chailly led the orchestra. He called the evening historic, not just because it was the first one since COVID closed the historic building. Chailly said the concert marked 75 years since another landmark moment at the Milan Performance Hall. In 1946, Arturo Toscanini conducted the first concert at La Scala after World War II. As for what comes next, Paolo Bezzana with La Scala hopes Italian authorities will soon loosen audience size restrictions. La Scala's opera season begins at the end of the month.
Everybody wants to come, and this is really important for us.
It is, after all, La Scala. A little more of last night's performance to walk us off stage today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.